Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And tonight I'm going to look at the relationship between British anti-fascism in the 1930s, domestically in Great Britain, the struggle against the British Union of Fascists, and the attraction of the international brigades in Spain to some of those who fought mostly as black shirts on the streets. Before we do, a bit of an announcement. We are, with any luck, on Wednesday going to be speaking with Mick Wright, the writer, the author of the Conquest of the Useless newsletter, former Telegraph journalist, and we are going to be discussing media ownership in Great Britain and beyond, and the historical importance of that. And you only need to look at pretty much the total anarchy that the Western world is in at the moment to get a flavour of why that's pretty topical. Okay, without further ado, let's look at Unlikely Warriors by Richard Baxall. A book that I've been talking about on and off for several years, which Baxall, along with Paul Preston, is one of the kind of the most interesting voices talking about the Spanish Civil War, and of course, along with Giles Tremlett, who's recently written a new history of the International Brigades, one which I'm definitely on my list. Somebody who's taken this really, what had been for a long time quite an obscure story, and brought it back front and centre into public consciousness. The International Brigades for many years were a kind of a legend of the British left, particularly, and obviously the left in other countries, but particularly beloved of the British left, but known very little, despite their extraordinary courage and resilience. Very little is known about them, was known about them beyond those circles, but books like Unlikely Warriors have really kind of brought them back into public prominence. So in chapter two, Richard Baxall writes about fighting the black shirts, and he says, "While many of the men and women who went to Spain had a long history of political activism, for others it was the rise of fascism in Europe and its homegrown version in the form of Sir Oswald Mosley's black shirts that principally lay behind their decision to fight. The establishment of the British Union of Fascists in 1932 was the first serious, if only partially successful, attempt in Britain to create a mass party in the image of continental fascist regimes." So, again, there's an interest. There's something quite interesting there. The fact that there were long-standing political activists, members of the Communist Party, members of kind of anarchist movements, who had engaged in all manner of activism over the years. And then all of a sudden, there was just simply the anti-fascist. Those men and women who had not really engaged in politics particularly, but found fascism so abhorrent that they had to struggle against it, irrespective of any political tradition. Some found their way into movements like the groups like the Communist Party of Great Britain. Others went to Spain, having little time for communism, but knowing that fascism was barbarism and had to be resisted. Mosley himself had previously been elected a Conservative MP, had crossed the floors in 1924 to join Labour, becoming an MP for Labour in 1926. He walked out of the Labour government in 1930 in anger when the Mosley Memorandum was ignored, his corporatist vision for the UK. He had quite a keen economic mind, and he established in 1931 the New Party, which has limited success. And then in 1932, on the advice and backing of Lord Rothermere, owner of the Daily Mail, formed the British Union of Fascists. Mosley, writes Richard Baxall, Mosley made use of all the fascist tricks, the uniforms, the grandiose stage shows, the speechifying and rolling eyes of Mussolini, and crucially, the violence. As members of the BUF later admitted, deliberately provoking violence was an essential part of the fascist programme, all part of a wider scheme to blame communists as a justification for seizing power by force. Membership of the BUF grew quickly and at its high watermark in the summer of 1934. The party comprised 134 branches with perhaps as many as 50,000 members. This rapid growth was partly due to members of the other smaller British fascist parties joining, but it was also due to a genuine appeal. There was no question that Mosley possessed a remarkable talent for oratory. According to one of the most foremost historians of British fascism, he was without peer as a public speaker in 20th century British politics. So the BUF's membership increased, and it gained, as mentioned, some powerful friends, one of those being Lord Rothermere, owner of the Daily Mail, who gave the Daily Mail, lent the Daily Mail support to the movement. Rothermere was a self-styled anti-communist. Perhaps that was more his motivation than outright fascism. But it gets to a certain point where there's very little distance between the two. Rothermere ran his infamous "Hurrah for the Black Shirts" headline front page, which ran on the 15th of January 1934, in which Rothermere wrote a kind of a glowing editorial saying that really there should be a similar movement that one finds in Italy and Germany now in Britain, and really the focus is to sort out the Reds and to give the country some order and discipline that it's strongly been lacking. Despite Mosley's denials at the time, the British Union of Fascists received substantial help from Mussolini in the region of about £60,000 between 1933 and 1936. The onlookers, the British onlookers, the British anti-fascists who had seen Italy go fascist in 1922 had seen a general slide into anti-democratic states across Europe throughout the 1920s, most of Eastern Europe by the end of the 1920s is in one undemocratic state or quasi-undemocratic state or another. And then from 1933 onwards, the world is transformed by the appointment of Hitler as Chancellor in January that year. The historian David Coate basically says that January 1933 is a dividing line in the history of the British left. And everything after that was their sympathies towards things like the Soviet Union was completely defined by the fact that Hitler was now in power in Germany, and that any compromise, any bargain, any deal, any arrangement, particularly with Stalinist Russia, needed to be embraced wholeheartedly, because Stalinist Russia seemed to be the only power with any hope of actually defeating a resurgent, rearmed Germany. In his book The Fellow Travellers, David Coates says basically that the whole direction of the Fellow Traveller movement, these British liberals and socialists who went to Russia to marvel over the five-year plans, the whole point of that before 1933 was to present a possible alternative to free market capitalism, which was in crisis as a result of the Great Depression after 1933, is purely to look for some kind of hope that there is somebody strong enough to stand against Nazi Germany. Their hopes are obviously devastated in August 1939 with the signing of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. In addition to that, throughout the mid-1930s, particularly when the Spanish Civil War began, the indifference of Britain, America and France to the fate of the Republic and the refusal to become involved, because principally either the calculation in London and Paris and Washington was that either a fascist power would win or a socialist one, and neither seemed particularly preferable or worth risking lives and British or American or French soldiers over in order to deal with. However, British anti-fascists looked at this indecision as a capitulation to Nazism, and those on the left concluded that this is something that capitalism would inevitably do, and capitalism would inevitably either roll over to fascism or deliberately use it as the kind of the attack dog to destroy the left. One transition in 1933 was the end of the class against class policy by Comintern. The idea that it was sensible for communist parties across Europe to attack social democratic parties, such as the KPD and the SPD in Germany. So the inability of the KPD and the SPD, the Communists and the Social Democrats, to form an electoral pact against Hitler, specifically on Stalin's orders, made his appointment all but inevitable by late 1932. So it was an enormous own goal on the part of Stalin. This was dropped as a concept after Hitler came to power. And the ability or the willingness of communist parties, particularly in Great Britain, to collaborate with those who they would normally have seen as their enemies was enhanced. And Richard Baxall writes, following the Communist Party's abandonment of its class-against-class policy in response to the rise of fascist authoritarian regimes across Europe, both the Communists and the Independent Labour Party appealed for a united front against fascism. However, the Labour Party remained deeply suspicious of its former critics, and their dramatic volte-face was unwilling to have anything to do with them.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
As the communists adopted the clandestine tactic of channeling anti-fascist activity through front organisations such as the British anti-war movement, headed by John Strachey, who had left Mosley's new party in disgust when it began to develop a fascist tone. During 1933, his support for the black shirts increased, so correspondingly did anti-fascist demonstrations by those perceiving themselves to be the targets of fascism, communists, members of the labour movement, and in particular Jews. There were a large number of British Jews in the International Brigades, the British Battalion of the International Brigade, obviously. From March 1933 onwards, there were increasing occurrences of confrontations between the radical left and the BUF, especially in London, where on several occasions BUF newspaper sellers were jostled or even attacked by Jewish activists. Other violent confrontations occurred during the year in cities such as Manchester, Stockton, and Oxford. Walter Gregory, who would later become a lieutenant and company commander in Spain, was involved in a number of attempts to disrupt the Nottingham branch of the BUF and was wounded in a demonstration at the city's Victoria Baths. While disrupting a meeting, Gregory got into a fight with a member of the audience before a steward hit him over the head with a chair, breaking his nose. As Gregory described, the Communist Party's tactics at fascist meetings were basically simple. Get as many members as possible into the meeting, and then once it was in progress, cause such disruption that the meeting could no longer continue, or the disturbance would have to be quelled by fascist stewards. So there was a kind of a very much milder version of the street violence that was happening, had happened in Germany in the run-up to the 1932 Reichstag elections there. The Labour Party had little interest in joining any kind of united front with the Communist Party, in part because they believed that the threat of fascism in Britain was being overstated, and being overstated in order to give the communists a kind of a platform to speak from, and to allow them to capture the concept of anti-fascism, which wasn't exactly kind of exciting the British population at the time. Though, as Richard Overy points out, in the Morbid Age, the British press, both for the working and middle classes, was overwhelmingly critical of Nazism, and opinion polls showed overwhelmingly that British people took a dim view of Nazi Germany. Richard Baxall writes, when the Communist Party organised a demonstration in Hyde Park on the 9th of September 1934, the press refused to publicise it. In response, the party attempted an innovative and highly effective guerrilla publicity campaign, led by a Welsh miner and Communist Party organiser, Bert Williams, who was to become a political commissar in Spain, responsible for maintaining morale and political orthodoxy within the communist-dominated international brigades. Measures included the hijacking of a BBC outside broadcast on the 3rd of September, this is 1934, as a result of which the protesters were labelled microphone bandits by the Daily Mirror. As many as a million leaflets were thrown from London rooftops, banners were hung from buildings such as Broadcasting House, and slogans were daubed across the city, including a call for workers to do their duty, painted on Nelson's column. Now that bit I really find really interesting, this idea of work, anti-fascism being a working class duty. And of course, in the 1930s, it was politically conscious working class men and women that saw themselves as being the key target of fascist violence, that working class people that were educated and aware of their circumstances and wanting to better them were most likely to be on the receiving end of a fascist boot. So the meeting in Hyde Park numbered perhaps as close to as many as 100,000, which was significantly bigger than the British Union of Fascists contingent, who found themselves totally surrounded, much like in 1936, at the Battle of Cable Street. This time, writes Richard Baxter, the booing and ridicule by the anti-fascists, the event remained remarkably peaceful. Faced with such organised resistance and growing official disquiet, membership of the BUF continued to decrease through 1935, with only 5,000 members remaining in October. So this shows you that if Britain did have a fascist moment, it was very, very fleeting. And perhaps there was something about the nature of British society in the 1930s, British parliamentary democracy, that meant that fascism was unable to grow the deep roots that it had in other parts of Europe. Perhaps the fact that Britain had won, or been on the winning side in the First World War, meant that there was little opportunity for the kind of revanchism that it was synonymous in both widespread and German and Italian fascism. So once Mosley adopted explicitly anti-Semitic policies, and this is very telling about Britain, the popularity of the British Union of Fascists grew again. Mosley claimed to oppose the behaviour of the Jews rather than the Jews themselves. So he tried to be a kind of a nuanced anti-Semite, saying, you know, I'm not racist, it is just that there's something, you see something about the Jews that they can't help but, you know, try to exploit people, which, you know, ironic that he came out with the classic sort of dinner party racist gaffe of, I'm not a bigot, but. In his book, Think in the 20th Century, Tony Judd, who grew up in post-Second World War Britain, has some really interesting recollections of what it's like to be the kind of the lone Jewish boy in school. Said that that Britain, and particularly England, is far more anti-Semitic than it thinks it is. And because there was the example of Nazi Germany, and Britain's anti-Semitism always manages to kind of go beneath the radar slightly. But this is an interesting clue, anyway. His protestations, writes Richard Baxter, failed to convince, particularly as his BUF foot soldiers seemed incapable of making the same fine distinction. Unsurprisingly, British Jews were quick to see the parallels between Mosley's movement and fascist European regimes, and were therefore prominent among those demonstrating against the black shirts. Although any reading of BUF speeches, with their frequent allusions to alien and foreign influences, demonstrated clearly enough that anti-Semitism had been present in Mosley's movement from the outset, the verbal and physical abuse of Jews, in which many BUF members were engaged, marked a change to a more offensive stance and the beginning of the BUF's move into overt anti-Semitism, which is how we reach the Battle of Cable Street, for example. Now, I just want to move on a little bit and look at the process of volunteering for Spain. In July 1936, the British newspapers begin to fill with stories of something occurring in Spain, and over the next few days, details begin to flood in about a military rising and the resistance of the Spanish government. And the fact that in certain parts of Spain, such as Barcelona, the Spanish left, in all its colours, took matters and also guns into their own hands. And the early indications were that the coup might possibly fail, but it wasn't clear that the Republican government would survive either. And so the response of the majority of the British public was to seek to turn one's attention away from Spain. Memories of the First World War were still very strong. One newsreel put it succinctly, "Heaven forbid that Spain's calamity should become Europe's scourge." And the popular mood was to ignore Spain and hope that Britain didn't become involved in any way. The conflict was no doubt hideous for Spain, thought many British people, but it was no concern of theirs. Randolph Churchill, Winston Churchill, said it was bad form to get hysterical about foreigners. Of course, with the advent of newsreels and radio, the realities of the Spanish Civil War flooded into British homes and met with a politically engaged generation of anti-fascist activists, the likes of which had never existed in Great Britain before, and predominantly working class, some of them communist, some of them not, but would listen and to Spanish activists who'd come from Spain to try to raise support for the Republic. When the opportunity to travel to Spain via the Communist Party, who helped to establish the International Brigade, the British Battalion of the International Brigade, and the other brigades were established through Comintern, it was very, very attractive to some unemployed men, some men with jobs, the women who went to serve in the International Brigades, Ambulance Corps and other auxiliary services, also deeply committed to the struggle against fascism. Getting to Spain, which we'll get onto in another podcast, was a whole other different and hazardous matter, particularly as by 1937 it had been made illegal in Great Britain and France to travel to engage in the Spanish Civil War. Anyway, I'm going to leave it there. Hopefully, I mean, we are very much looking forward to getting Mick on the show this coming Wednesday. So tune into that. It's going to be a real pleasure. And thanks very much for listening. And thanks very much for everyone that's currently supporting the Explaining History podcast on Patreon. Big thanks to Jane Erglis and her kind donation. And we'll be getting some new content on there for you pretty soon. Thanks very much. All the best, everyone. Thanks and bye-bye.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.